This is Lecture 5, The Dynamics of Modern Enclosure and Governing the Commons. The themes of this week's lecture are about the varieties of modern enclosure and of nature and the dynamics of enclosure. And we'll proceed from there to Professor Eleanor Ostrom's work about the design principles of successful commons. And we'll conclude with a brief discussion of a terrific documentary film, The Gleaners and I, by Agnès Varda, who's a French documentary filmmaker, which depicts a huge variety of contemporary gleaners, people who scavenge from what the market leaves behind, from the fields, from dumpsters, from other places. And we'll talk about that. Now, enclosure is a big part of this story because it's really one of the large neglected stories of our time about how the market has been colonizing all sorts of publicly owned resources, aspects of culture, and areas of social life that previously had lain outside of the market. And it's taking such resources as public lands with its timber, minerals, grazing lands. It's taking the public domain of knowledge, works that were created in the 1920s and 30s and before. It's taking areas of life that have historically had their own autonomy, such as academia, education in for school children, social life, outer space, genes, the deep seabed, and many other areas, and it's imposing a market regime of control and management on it. Now, when a market takes over a commons and makes it subservient to the cash economy, to contracts, to all the other dynamics of a market, it changes the management and character of the resource. And this is sometimes subtle, but as we'll see in some examples, it can be profound as well in changing the social relationships that people have, in changing the sustainability of the management of the resource. A good example that highlights both a commons and market enclosure is organic agriculture. This was a regime of a commons in which people had a commitment to natural foods, and they wanted food to be pesticide-free, they wanted it to be more nutritious, they wanted it to be local so they could meet with the people who were growing their food as well as having a more energy-efficient food distribution chain. They wanted animals raised in a humane way. They wanted to preserve family farms and the local landscape and its beauty. And so organic farming was a part of this whole set of values and ways of being. The market was inscribed in this larger social context as opposed to dominating the social context. Now, the history of the past 20 or 30 years has been of the marketplace starting to recognize the consumer interest and value of organic food and starting to enclose it. So particularly after a few pesticide scares in the 1990s, large food corporations saw that there were great profits to be made from enclosing the commons. So they began acquiring and consolidating small farms that served local customers, and they began to integrate them into national markets, which they then bolstered with branding and advertising. And so you had major food conglomerates owning organic food and its both its creation, processing, and distribution. Now, this changed the whole character of organic food. In some ways, it made it more accessible to people, but in other ways, it started to degrade the very integrated nature of food production with local economies and local people. As Michael Pollan wrote at the time, maybe 10 years ago, in the eyes of General Mills, an organically grown fruit or vegetable is not part of a revolution, but part of a marketing niche, and health is a matter of consumer protection. You don't have to buy into an organic belief system to sell it. The broccoli is trucked to Alberta, Canada, there to meet up with pieces of organic chicken that have already made a stop at a processing plant in Salem, Oregon, where they were defrosted, injected with marinade, cubed, cooked, and refrozen. Now, the point of I'm trying to make is that national food processors were not interested in the values and social practices of organic agriculture. They were interested in appropriating the name and credibility of organic food and monetizing it because they saw that it had value. But they wanted to do so in the cheapest possible way, which of course meant shedding the commitments that traditional organic farmers and consumers had to the whole organic worldview and process. So national food processors have worked very hard to degrade the standards of defining organic foods set by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. For the food company executive, lunch is just lunch. It's a commodity that you buy. It's not something that has personal or moral dimensions or commitments, the way that many people who committed to organic farming believe it should be. Now, my point in telling this story is to illustrate the tension between markets, especially highly capitalized markets, and the commons, and how sometimes when the market gets too much of an upper hand, it simply encloses the commons and prevents its quality of or type of value from being generated in the first place. Enclosure has many benefits, or some benefits. It has predictability and standardization and efficiency, although that may be qualified if it's a major conglomerate or monopoly, and profitability, most of all. But what's lost when enclosure occurs is the unexpected, the creative, the local, all the things that are distinctive, which tend to be more idiosyncratic and unplanned. That's what occurs in the commons, but the market is highly regimented because, of course, it's intent on obtaining as much return on capital as possible. In some respects, enclosure is associated with Americanization, or at least the worst aspects of Americanization, in the sense of commodifying whatever can be commodified for market purposes, and an associated loss of authenticity and localism. Now, it's a fair question to say, how does enclosure proceed? What makes it happen? What drives it? Well, there's a number of forces, but I suppose the easiest one to name is outright appropriation. A business, a corporation, will simply seize something that has value. Maybe it hadn't been part of the market in the past. Maybe it was publicly owned, government owned, but it proceeds to try to secure the resource for itself. Sometimes it's a matter of developing new technologies that can claim it. So, for example, new genetic engineering technologies that can claim patents on genes, and those patents may require Congress or court decisions to help recognize the legality of the privatization. So sometimes it's technology, sometimes it's the legislation or court decisions or federal agency rules that are required to formally and legally recognize that a company can privatize a resource. One example is a 1980 Supreme Court decision, the famous Chakrabarty ruling, which for the first time allowed the ownership, the private ownership of microorganisms. This opened the door for a lot of extensions of that principle so that companies can now own life forms. Harvard University owns a specially bred laboratory mouse, the so-called Onco mouse, which is often used to do experiments for carcinogenicity of substances. Congress, another example of Congress colluding in enclosure was the Copyright Term Extension Act of 1998, which retroactively extended the term of copyright law by 20 years, so that works that were about to enter the public domain, or in fact had entered the public domain because their term of 70 years had expired, were now suddenly back under private control. This was a giveaway worth billions of dollars to various copyright industries, particularly the film and music industries. Federal agencies can sometimes on their own allow companies to seize public information and research. So, for example, federal research and development on new drugs is exceedingly valuable, particularly because the government sponsors the more difficult, risky breakthrough research, whereas industry is very reluctant to take on those kinds of risks and expenses. But then the government will go turn around and virtually give away this research to the drug companies, who often have to do a relatively little bit of additional research and clinical testing to turn it into a highly lucrative drug. Taxol, a cancer drug, is one example of this. Then there's a lot of government information resources that have been given over to private industry for no cost and for no good reason. There's no reason why federal court decisions, which we taxpayers pay for, should be privately controlled. But West Publishing Company has a de facto monopoly, or some might say oligopoly, over control of access to federal court decisions, even though the federal courts could easily create a public domain notation system that would allow court rulings to be made far more accessible, either for free or on a much more competitive basis than exists today. So these are examples of the kind of enclosure that's going on today. Enclosure proceeds by alienating, that means making for sale, making available for sale on the market, alienating resources that belong to the public or that arguably should be inalienable. Things like wilderness, genetic information, space, and so forth. There's things like our children's consciousness in school. Should that be a resource to be mined by advertisers? In many instances, it is. There's Channel One, the pseudo-news program that force-feeds advertising to school children in the guise of news. Advertisers love it because it's a very fixed demographic cohort and children who are very impressionable. There's things like Civic Stadium, which often the naming rights have been sold. A company can name the stadium after itself, even though it might only pay a fraction of the total cost of the stadium. The rest will be borne by taxpayers. And then there's social life, which is often commercialized through, say, ambush advertising in elevators or gas pumps, where you suddenly have a video ad. And then some advertisers even hire people to be undisclosed shills, talking up a product in a bar, for example. It's kind of an insidious degradation of social life to commercialize it without disclosing that you're being advertised to. So these are kinds of some of the issues that enclosure entails. The focus of much of today will be about the enclosure of nature. And this is becoming a very urgent question because the carrying capacity of nature is being overwhelmed by the marketization of it. Can the atmosphere continue to absorb more carbon from an ever-growing economy that requires fossil fuels? Can species extinction be slowed when so much habitat is being lost to commercial development? Can fresh water be saved when so many companies are trying to claim private rights in groundwater supplies and bottle water that belongs to all of us and then charge a whole lot for branded water? There's issues about wetlands destruction, water pollution, invasive species, and the destruction that's causing to ecosystems. You have genetically modified organisms in crops, which are supplanting the biodiversity that nature needs to survive and substituting monocultures, which are very vulnerable to disease and more fragile. There's the introduction of alien genes into ecosystems that is potentially disruptive in ways we don't really understand quite yet. So the enclosures of nature are an enormous issue and challenge, and the corresponding challenge is to find new and better ways to protect the commons of nature from these enclosures. The basic problem is that the market prefers to treat nature as an inert object, as a proto-commodity, not as a living organism that has its own dynamics, its own needs, in which we're wrapped up in the, we humans are wrapped up in those needs of dynamic ecosystems. And so we need to learn to start to recognize nature just not as a field for market appropriation and monetization, but it's something that has its own intrinsic values in itself. One of the first people to raise an alarm about this was Aldo Leopold, the great conservationist and ecologist. And in his famous book, A Sand County Almanac, he wrote in 1949 he wrote about the land ethic, which he was trying to promote. And he said, a land ethic is simply this, quote, quit thinking about decent land use solely as an economic problem. Examine each question in terms of what is ethically and aesthetically right, as well as what's economically expedient. A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. Now, this is a kind of landmark statement about the non-commodified nature of nature, and it's a good starting point for starting to recover the commons. Market discourse sees exchange value. It doesn't tend to see the thing in itself, because to recognize the thing in itself would imply a need to respect it more, to assert limits, and to back off from the monetization and propertization of of nature. The problem is that people participating in markets have trouble seeing the subtle generative powers of nature, many of which tend to be very complex and long-term and not necessarily marketable. For many years, and even today, many people regard wetlands and swamps as really just wastelands because they don't see the ecological value of those types of land. Bats have been reviled for the same reason. They're ugly, even though, of course, they play an enormously important ecological role. So there's been a lot of breeding of animals and seeds that can diminish the biodiversity and make less resilient the genetic structures of seeds and animals. We've seen this with cows, for example, and corn, where they've been so highly bred that they're more vulnerable to disease, and they're not able to protect themselves from all sorts of organisms that can more easily penetrate them. Now, it bears noting that humans can and have often worked with nature to improve its stability and its diversity as well. But the point I'm trying to make is it's a matter of working with nature and co-evolving with it, and not trying to treat it as an object and manage it simply as a market order for maximum profitability. It's important to realize that establishing a gift relationship with nature can introduce a whole different attitude that I believe can help develop a more sustainable forms of management. I like especially a quote from Wendell Berry, the poet and environmentalist, who wrote, "We know enough of our history by now to be aware that people exploit what they've merely conceded to be a value, but they defend what they love. To defend what we love, we need a particularizing language, for we love what we particularly know." This is why the language of the market, which asserts a very highly specialized kind of value, namely monetized value, is not adequate. It can't grapple with the complexities of value, which in nature are highly complex and not necessarily lucrative, and the value that we have as human beings in our relationships with nature and animals. So this is a reason for developing the particularizing language of the commons. Now, a very important concept when we talk about commons is inalienability. There's a fantastic book by Stanford Law Professor Margaret Jane Raden called Contested Commodities, the trouble with trade in sex, children, body parts, and other things. And what Radin does is develop a rather comprehensive critique of why things should be inalienable, what it means to say that something is inalienable. There's all sorts of things that we instinctively say, you know, that shouldn't be for sale. Things like babies and genes and sex and body organs. These are things that most people agree shouldn't be treated as a commodity. Around the edges, there are often disputes about this, but this deserves more inquiry about why exactly we decide something shouldn't be alienable. Well, the answer has a lot to do with different orders of value. Usually the market order regards something as fungible and substitutable, meaning if you have a given price, $100, anything else that's $100 is more or less substitutable because they have the same value. But to assert the commons, to talk about the commons, to talk about something being inalienable, is to assert a different notion of value and a different notion of personhood and freedom than what the market implies. When we talk about value in the marketplace, we're talking about a universal system of value where all value can be expressed on the same scale. And we're talking about exclusive rights of private property and the ability or right to transfer that private property for cash in the marketplace. Well, this is a very distinctive worldview of what is value and what is personal freedom and what a person should be all about. Margaret Jane Radin calls it a worldview of universal commodification, a one-dimensional world of value in which anything that may be desired, whether tangible or social or religious or moral, can be conceived of as a commodity that can be bought and sold in a free market. The point is that all value can be expressed in terms of price, and price is somewhat glibly associated with happiness and progress, or as economists might put it, utility maximization. Now, this is a caricature in some respects, but in other ways, not really, because many economists, especially the Chicago School of Economics, go pretty far in asserting this mental framework of value. And they are constantly trying to find ways to express intangible social, environmental, personal values through a price, or if that's not immediately possible, through some proxy which can express it. So you have all these sub-disciplines like cost-benefit analysis and hedonics, which is about the measurement of pleasure, or other analytic techniques that try to determine the market value of intangibles. So, for example, what's a worker willing to pay to avoid a fatal injury on the job? And so a willingness to pay is a proxy market value for what a worker will pay to avoid a toxic chemical death, for example. And this is supposed to be, then you can plug this into a cost-benefit equation and say, well, it doesn't make any sense. It's not worthwhile or efficient to curb that hazard because it's the cost exceeds the so-called benefit of that person's life. Gary Becker and Judge Richard Posner are two people most associated with this point of view, and they've actually applied the notion of market rhetoric to babies. Perhaps there should be a market in babies because the market could help sort out what's truly valuable or not, and perhaps this might make babies more accessible to certain people, and it might give poor people more money for selling their babies. Margaret Jane Radin uses this example to sort of show the limits to which some scholars have gone in thinking that market rhetoric can apply to these inappropriate realms. But it also illustrates the extreme objectification that market rhetoric often imposes. It's a system where, Radin says, commodities are socially constructed as objects separate from the self and social relationships. See, then that's a very important point, because the market allows us to objectify something as distinct from us out there, whereas the commons, by contrast, is asserting that the self and our social relationships are bound up in the object. And so we have a very different notion of personhood and freedom than a market, where personhood is seen as working well when a person has freedom to buy and sell whatever he wants. That improves his freedom, his autonomy, his satisfaction, his utility maximization, the economist would call it. So that's a whole regime of value. One of the points of talking about the commons is it helps assert a different framework of value than the market is otherwise inclined to provide, which often can't provide. There are a lot of critics of what could be called value commensurability, the idea that all value can be collapsed into a single scale and expressed in price. Two books that are worth looking at in this respect are Frank Ackerman and Liza Henserling's book, Priceless, on knowing the price of everything and the value of nothing. And then law professors Thomas McGarity, Sidney Shapiro, and myself produced a volume called Sophisticated Sabotage, The Intellectual Games Used to Subvert Responsible Regulation. A lot of that book talks about cost-benefit analysis and risk assessment. The problem is that the formal quantitative and one might even say fundamentalist version of commodification that the market is all about is coherent, formal, and pretty black and white in times. And so a lot of people think that it's more reliable because it's so clear and seemingly rigorous, whereas people who believe that value can't be collapsed into price don't often have a coherent or quantitative way of expressing it. It's qualitative, and so it's often dismissed as merely subjective. But I would argue that that's the way we live. We live in our subjective worlds, and this objectification is highly artificial and ultimately unsatisfying and often value-destructive way of expressing things. It has its role, but it shouldn't be the sole arbiter of value, the way it has become, especially in regulatory agencies. Now, Radin points out that some people believe very deeply that all values are commensurable, and that if you make a choice among very different types of things, you're simply making a trade-off. And this is apparently a very old impulse that in philosophy that goes back as far as Plato, the idea of trying to get this single scale of commensurability for value. The problem, as Radin points out, is that the market rhetoric as a primary language of value makes it very, very difficult to acknowledge other social or moral commitments. It's hard for them to be fully represented when the market is asserted as the only way to express it. And one could say that in the past 10 or 20 years, this tendency has only intensified. With the rise of eBay, for example, we have the spectacle of people selling human eggs, their right to vote, even their virginity on eBay. And there's greater calls for making organ donations of hearts or kidneys, something that's subject to the market, because that would presumably increase the supply. What they often don't note is that the only people who would sell their body organs are those who are very poor or from developing countries, people in need. So it's hardly a bargain between a free bargain between two equals. So these raise very important questions about what type of world we want to live in, what vision we have for humanity and personhood. And I believe that one key why it's important to talk about the commons is to be able to challenge this all-pervasive notion of market value and to begin to assert that we have other ways to express value that need to be defended and protected. And one reason this is important is because the way that we talk about resources helps us, is itself important in how we construct our social behaviors. When we use this market rhetoric, it is in a way creating our cultural reality and how we will interact with each other and the resource. And as I suggested earlier, this can have really harmful consequences for nature if we treat it merely as an object and not something that deserves our respect, that is animate and has its own needs. We saw in Karl Polanyi's book, The Great Transformation, what happens when we begin to treat labor and land as a commodity. He pointed out quite usefully that this is a fiction, and it may have some value, but it also is a fiction that starts us down the road towards treating human labor and people as mere commodities and treating land as a commodity that is implicitly substitutable and fungible, an object. So part of our challenge is to transcend that kind of language, that conceptualization of each other and nature, and to approach it in a different way. And when we talk about the commons, when we talk about inalienability of things, that's the first step for starting to assert limits on the colonization of the market order and to assert a more personal and social and ecological form of value that can be protected. The basic idea that Radin leaves us with is that inalienability is important to our notions of human flourishing. It's hard to assert a bright line, principled rule for what should or should not be alienable for market use. But because circumstances and culture vary so much. But in the end, it does come down to what we consider important to human flourishing, and the kind of flourishing that the market provides is only one dimension of what we need in life. I found recently a fascinating counterpoint to the market rhetoric in a book called Property Outlaws: How Squatters, Pirates, and Protesters Improve the Law of Ownership. It's by Eduardo Penalver and Sonia Katyal. It was recently published by Yale University Press. And what makes the book interesting is their argument that property outlaws over the decades and generations have helped improve property law by pointing out that property is too expansive and too absolute. The civil rights protesters who sat down at the Woolworth lunch counters during the civil rights era, they were challenging the right of private property to exclude them on the basis of race, because it was seen as a right of property owners to discriminate, even if it was a public establishment that was privately owned. And this can be seen today in all sorts of challenge by property outlaws to the asserted property claims of copyright and patent holders. So you have civil disobedience against software owners who claim that they can encrypt their software or DVDs so that it can only run on certain types of machines. There was a famous case where a hacker took Linux. He wanted to run his DVDs on Linux and not just Windows, and he hacked the DVD, created a program so it could run on a Linux computer. Well, this was violating the property rights officially of the owner of that DVD, yet it was asserting a new claim that property shouldn't be that extensive and that the public, the social community, should have its own rights to use that resource. The same thing occurred when drug companies claimed patents in AIDS and HIV drugs and charged exorbitant sums for those drugs while people were dying because they couldn't afford access to the drugs. So there was, again, civil disobedience against those claims for property law. You have the Diebold voting machines, the Diebold electronic voting machines, which had were discovered to have software flaws so that votes could be manipulated. Well, when this was revealed by some activists, the Diebold company asserted copyright in some of the leaked documents that were had been put on the web by the activists. Again, should the property right claim be able to prevent the public disclosure of the flaws in a voting machine? The point of all these kind of stories is that it's through social interaction between people and property rights holders that new definitions of property law are established, and that the appeal to the general public, to a sense of fairness and ethics, are often important in limiting the scope of property laws in very socially constructive ways. Without those challenges to the Woolworth lunch counters, we wouldn't have limitations on property rights that required property holders in public establishments to be non-discriminatory. That's an important development. But let's move on now from this discussion of enclosure and property rights to what makes a successful commons. How can a commons protect itself against the ravages of enclosure? We turn first to Professor Eleanor Ostrom, who has been such a pioneer in developing new analytic frameworks and theories for understanding how successful commonses work. Ostrom starts her landmark 1990 work, Governing the Commons, by identifying three prevailing metaphors for why commonses can't work. There is, of course, the famous tragedy of the commons metaphor that Garrett Hardin introduced us to in 1968 with his essay in Science Journal, that if too many people use the commons, it results in its overexploitation and ruin, the tragedy of the commons. But there are also a whole literature of so-called prisoner dilemma experiments in which scientists would get test subjects to interact with each other, usually in highly controlled and modeled ways, so that the participants could not communicate with each other or talk. And the point was to see how they would maximize their self-interest rationally. And most often, the outcome of the experiment showed that people couldn't work together to mutually maximize their respective self-interest, that one had to betray the other to maximize, rationally improve their self-interest. And this was also a theme in Mancur Olson's 1965 book, The Logic of Collective Action, which again laid out the theory that collective action is for the most part either irrational or impossible, and that private self-interest is the way to go. Eleanor Ostrom's big achievement was to challenge this then prevailing wisdom and show that in an empirical way they were wrong, that individuals are not really helpless to organize and cooperatively manage resources, but they can do so. But, and here's the key point, there must be certain institutional arrangements to allow them to come together, communicate, develop trust, and build those commons institutions. Ostrom identifies the conditions that need to exist for the commoners to be able to self-organize and sustain a commons. She ultimately identified 8 design principles about which we'll return to in a minute, but she also concedes that there's no adequate theory to explain why some groups of individuals can succeed in creating commonses while others can't. She does identify how there are some key problems that need to be addressed. One is the management of the appropriation of a resource. How do people use it? The fishery, the timber, the water. Another key problem is how to develop mutual commitment among commoners. And a third is how to developing ways to monitor the usage of the resource and enforce anybody, take enforcement action against anyone who might abuse or free ride the resource. So there's three general ways that she identified to overcome these problems. One is through a process of communication. The other is through the building of trust. And a third is through the envisioning of a shared future, which is something that culture can speak to through its rituals and narratives and shared experiences. There could be other factors, Ostrom notes, things like the openness of the governance regime so that, you know, if commoners don't even have the autonomy to develop their own institutional structures, then the communication, trust, and shared future are never going to develop. So there might have to be a situation where the state is not dominating the community, or there's no market monopolies that are preventing people from organizing the way they want to. The point is that economists and other theorists at the time had concluded that only external coercion could solve the tragedy of the commons. The economists said that you needed either a coercive government or a private property regime of markets to solve the tragedy of the commons. But Ostrom's big achievement was to show that the commons could, in fact, self-organize. Her goal, for much of her career, has been to develop what she calls an adequately specified theory of collective action, whereby a group of principals can organize themselves voluntarily to retain the residuals of their own efforts. The examples that she cited were cooperatives or law firms organized as partnerships, where a group of people come together to manage and retain the benefits that they collectively generate. She wanted to understand how individuals organize and govern themselves to obtain collective benefits in situations where the temptations to free ride and to break commitments to each other are quite substantial. Now, it's worth pausing a moment to note that there's a difference between common pool resources, which is a somewhat academic way of talking about commons, and public goods. Ostrom was focusing on CPRs, common pool resources, not on public goods, because public goods don't have the same problems, that don't have the problems of crowding or overuse that commons is due. Public goods don't have problems of what economists call the subtractability of the resource, whereas commons are finite and subtractible. There's only so much of them can be used before they're used up. So that's an important thing to keep in mind here. Another key factor when talking about commons is the interdependence of the appropriators. There are lots of people that want to appropriate and use the resource, but they're all interdependent. How does one deal with a circumstance in a way that results in more optimal long-term usage benefits for everybody? Well, the typical strategies for dealing with this interdependence, yet the limits of the resource, is to coordinate action or to use the resource in a sequential way or a limited way. You may recall from the previous lecture we talked about the stinting of the commons, where there were certain socially imposed limits on how you could use the commons. Sometimes this might involve reducing usage or staggering the frequency of usage. And then, of course, to make sure that everybody abides by the rules, you need mutual monitoring as a way to solve the commitment problem, to make sure that everybody buys into it and, in fact, respects the rules. Now, Ostrom is quite conscientious in how she applies her theory, because she freely acknowledges she has no good theory for why some communities succeed in establishing commons as while others don't. But her real achievement, I believe, is to articulate a new analytic structure for assessing why some commonses work and some don't. So, for example, she talks about appropriation problems versus provisioning problems. An appropriation problem is how to allocate a fixed amount of what she calls resource flow, say irrigation water or fish from a fishery, how to allocate that among people in ways that prevent it from being overused or provoking conflict or uncertainty. But then the other problem, separate from appropriation, is provision problems. How do you maintain the resource or asset itself, which is distinct from the resource flow that comes from the resource? So, and then Ostrom also makes some very valuable contributions in saying that collective action problems need to be analyzed on a variety of levels. There's the operational choices in how to manage the resource, but then there's the larger governance rules and policy making, which are sort of a level above the operational choices of management. And then above those governance rules, you have